Architects, dedicated to enhancing the local Champaign community, on the web at ratioarchitects.com. Support for this broadcast comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Now featuring new offerings for the holidays. Wine tastings every Saturday from 2 to 6, and beer and spirit tastings on Sundays from 3 to 5. Information at thecorkscrew.com.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon and thanks for tuning in. I'm Celeste Quinn. Despite having serious doubts about the advisability of an invasion of Iraq, Secretary of State Colin Powell never advised the Bush administration against war. And it was Powell who carried the administration's case against Iraq to the United Nations in February 2003, 6 weeks before the invasion was launched. Why didn't the secretary advise against war? To what extent did he voice his concerns? Did he consider resigning? Those are some of the questions we'll take up this afternoon with journalist Karen DeYoung of The Washington Post. She is the author of the new biography, Soldier, The Life of Colin Powell. This is the first full biography of Colin Powell. It also examines the inner workings of the administration and the process that led the U.S. to war in Iraq. Soldier, The Life of Colin Powell is not an authorized biography, but Powell gave DeYoung 6 in-depth, on-the-record interviews and unrestricted access to his papers at the National Defense University Library in Washington, D.C. Soldier, The Life of Colin Powell is published by Knopf. And let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest, Karen DeYoung. She is an associate editor at The Washington Post. She's also served as a foreign policy reporter for the paper in Washington and a correspondent abroad. She's the recipient of numerous awards for her work, including the 2002 Pulitzer given to the Post for national coverage of the war on terrorism. Karen DeYoung, welcome.
Thank you, Celeste. Nice to be here.
In the first chapter of this book, you note Colin Powell never advised against the invasion, although he had warned the president of the difficulties and counseled patience. What were Powell's concerns and what did he tell the president?
Powell tended to look at the invasion of Iraq as a repeat of his what he considered his own war, the 1991 U.S. effort that ousted Iraqi forces from Kuwait. That war had not only a very large force of about 500,000 U.S. troops, but also a U.N. mandate and strong international support in terms of actual military forces. They had Arab military forces as part of the coalition and a lot of people from Europe, but also financial support and diplomatic support. And he felt that it was possible to duplicate that in invading Iraq to unseat Saddam Hussein. He didn't feel like there was an urgency to do it, that it was more important to do it right, to get the timing right and to get the force components right. And he urged the president to consider that and also to consider what would happen after the war, to make sure that there was a good plan, to realize that once Saddam Hussein was overthrown and the Ba'ath Party hierarchy was destroyed, that there would be no government there, that the United States would essentially own Iraq, and it had to have a good plan to deal with it. Again, to repeat what you said, he never said it was a bad idea to invade Iraq, simply that some consideration ought to be given to the need to have allies along with the United States and to have a good plan to do it.
How strongly did he deliver that message?
Well, he delivered it several times, but always in the context of telling the president that he would go along with what the president decided and making it very clear that it was the president's decision to make and not his.
Okay. Now, for 4 years, as you know, Powell had found himself in regular combat with conservative ideologues, including the vice president and secretary of defense. How did that affect the message he was able to convey to the president about Iraq?
I think it seriously undercut it. Powell was curiously passive in dealing with the vice president and the secretary of defense, who played by different rules than he did. He was used to a very structured environment. He's a big believer in institutions. And his past experience, certainly in the Reagan administration and in the first Bush administration of the current president's father, was that decisions should be made in a very orderly way, that everyone should have the opportunity to air their views and debate an issue, and that obviously the final decision was the president's, but only after he was aware of all the options and all the pitfalls of every option. That was not the case in this administration. Powell felt that certainly the vice president, who was with the president for a large portion of nearly every day, and with the defense secretary, who had his own back-channel communications with the president, Powell felt that he was outnumbered, and he certainly was outmaneuvered, to the dismay of a lot of his colleagues in the State Department, who felt he should fight dirtier and be more aggressive. He did not change his tactics. He believed that his way of doing business was to continue to press what he thought were the right ideas, to make sure, to the extent he could, that the president was aware of the options ahead of him that would eventually prevail for him, because it always had in the past. That was how he did business in the past. He had been enormously successful in the past. And he was, I believe, very slow to realize that that strategy was not working with this White House.
Yeah. When did he realize he was odd man out?
Well, I think that came very quickly. Certainly in the first year, there were several instances in the first year on North Korea policy, on the administration's policy toward the Kyoto Agreement on global climate change, where he was out front espousing policies, and it was very quickly had the rug pulled out from under him. I believe that certainly in the lead-up to the 9/11 attacks, that he was coming to realize that he was very much outnumbered and outflanked in the administration. And again, this whole decision-making process that he really had a difficult time getting a handle on.
Yeah. At the same time, as the title of your book suggests, Colin Powell is a soldier. He has been from the time he was in college, when he first joined the ROTC, his life was as a soldier, and so he stood by his commander-in-chief. Isn't it ironic, though, that, you know, here's a soldier in the State Department who is up against the Pentagon as the institution that is driving foreign policy?
You know, in a way, I think that was part of the problem for him. When he was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he was very reluctant to take advice from outsiders. He felt that people outside the military hierarchy really didn't understand the way the military operated, and he was resentful and rejected a lot of advice that came from the outside. He felt when he became Secretary of State that the people who were now in power in the Pentagon, certainly in the Joint Staff, and equally in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, really would not accept advice from him. And he was right. He did maintain his back channels with the military itself. He has, as all generals do, you know, had a lot of friends who were generals and people in uniform who were very unhappy with the way that Secretary Rumsfeld was running the Pentagon and with the war planning for Iraq. He felt, however, that he should voice his disagreements and his unhappiness within the structure that was the structure of the National Security Council, and when he had the opportunity, to the president himself. Clearly, that turned out not to be enough. And again, there were many people who worked for Powell who gradually became more and more frustrated by what they saw as a seeming passivity in his attempts to push what they thought were the right policies. I think that, you know, it's sort of conventional wisdom about Powell that he's a soldier, mm-hmm. and he follows the chain of command and would not dispute the president as his commander-in-chief. And like all conventional wisdom, I think there's a lot of truth to that. But I think in Powell's case, there were other things at work. Part of it was this reluctance to second-guess the military or, try to second-guess the military. And part of it, too, was a kind of overweening self-confidence where he, again, had been so successful in the past, had his views had always prevailed. He really had not lost many battles throughout his career, and he believed that if he continued on in the way he was used to doing business, that ultimately, in fact, he would prevail.
So he never considered tendering his resignation?
No, and I think that was, both because he believed that one of his idols was George Marshall, who was the other four-star general who served as Secretary of State under President Truman, and he was very much aware of, there's a very famous story about General Marshall, who objected to President Truman's decision to recognize the State of Israel before the rest of the United Nations had a chance to consider it, and Marshall very much objected to that, as did the people who worked with him in the State Department, and he went to Truman and said he thought that was not the right decision, and Truman said he was going to do it anyway. When Marshall went back to the State Department and met with his aides, and they all said, well, you'll have to resign. I mean, you've laid it on the line with this, and you really believe that this is the wrong decision, and you'll have to resign, and Marshall replied that he was not the person who was elected to make decisions. He was chosen by the president to give his best advice to the president. He had done that, and it was the president that the American people had elected to make decisions. And Powell often referred to this story with Marshall, saying that it wasn't his decision to make, that he had done his duty by giving his best advice. At the same time, I think that he's a very proud man, and he saw even the threat of resignation as an admission of defeat, that the people whom he saw as his adversaries within the administration, primarily Vice President Cheney and Defense Secretary Rumsfeld, would take that as a sign of victory, and that by leaving the administration, his views, which were very much in the minority anyway, would no longer be part, even in a minor sense, of their discussions, and that would not be the right thing for the country.
In hindsight, he'd stick with the same decision?
Oh, I think he would. I think he was never going to resign. It was just never going to happen. Again, it's not part of his makeup, and one of the things I kind of set out to do in the book by looking at his heritage and his background and his growing up through within an immigrant community. His parents are Jamaican, in a very multiracial community during the civil rights movement, a time of huge transformation in the military itself. That decision, the decision not to resign, never entered his mind, and that if you look at how he was brought up and the components of his personality, I believe it's very clear that was never going to happen, that it was not something that he was ever going to do.
Journalist Karen DeYoung of the Washington Post is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of Soldier, The Life of Colin Powell. Let's take a call or two now. First, we take a call on line one, a listener in Champaign. Line one, go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
I understand what you're saying about General Powell, and believe me, as an African-American, not a Jamaican, Afro-Caribbean-American as he is, there are things that are very principled, I believe, in communities of color. And one of them is that you do resign as a matter of principle when it seems like you've misled the nation, either wittingly or unwittingly. And I'm not sure whether he was guilty of a deliberate misrepresentation at the U.N., negligent or innocent, but it became evident after this speech and after the fruitless search for weapons of mass destruction that there was something amiss with what had been projected to the nation as the basis for going to war and putting men and women in harm's way. So I come down on his being unprincipled. And not resigning after it became evident that he sold the country and the world of bogus goods. And so how do you feel about that? I just don't think there is any way that a man who supposedly has what I think he should have in his constitution could remain on board an administration that had misled the American people into a war that violated the Powell Doctrine, which he had when he was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and in Gulf War I.
Well, I think you have to separate those two things, the Powell Doctrine, which calls for overwhelming use of force with popular support and an exit strategy before any kind of military action is launched. Certainly, he expressed his view that the force was too small, but as he said, he didn't die on his sword over it. And that goes back to his whole conception of not wanting to interfere with the military when he was no longer in the chain of command. He did argue somewhat more forcefully for a better post-war plan and more troops on the ground after the invasion, after the government was ousted in Iraq, but again did not prevail there. And I think a very curious and unfortunate thing happened. The relations at that time between the Pentagon and the State Department were so bad that there was a rising feeling in the State Department that if the Pentagon wanted to make all the rules and have all the control in Iraq, then perhaps the State Department decided, well, we'll just let them do it because they will see that their plan is wrong, and then we'll be called in to pick up all the pieces. Of course, when that happened, at the time sovereignty was returned to Iraq and an embassy was opened there, it was far too late, and the insurgency there was well underway, and many, many chances had been missed. But I think that was a function of relations between those two departments that had been so bad for so long that the Iraq strategy suffered and became even worse than it had started out. And that's, to some extent, the fault of the White House and Condoleezza Rice as National Security Advisor, whose job it is to try and build a cohesive whole out of those departments and to give comprehensive advice to the president himself. On the question of resignation, again, I think a curious thing went on in Powell's mind where he convinced himself that even if the weapons of mass destruction were not there, that enough was found on the ground in Iraq to prove that Saddam Hussein still had the capability and the intention to put together a weapons of mass destruction program, and therefore the United States was justified in invading and getting rid of him. I think history will not be particularly kind to that judgment, and I think it was a miscalculation on his part. But again, I don't think that resignation was ever a part of his makeup, for good or ill.
Could it be a function of political expedience? It also, I know to become a chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and I was in the military for 22 years of a lot of politics, and he has benefited from being caught up in this political environment. Could political expedience, what it meant in the long term in terms of great speaking fees, also have played a role in his staying on? And I think he should have resigned immediately.
I don't think it was in his head that he would make more speaking fees because arguably, if he had resigned, he certainly, if we look at what's happening in Iraq now, his reputation would be probably higher than it is right now, and he would get even higher fees. You know, I think that when he was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he thought of himself as apolitical, somebody who didn't have any politics. But in fact, he was very politically astute. He knew how to operate in Washington. He had alliances with powerful members of Congress in the Republican and Democratic parties. He formed alliances, certainly in the first Bush administration, with Jim Baker, who was Secretary of State, who they found common ground on a lot of foreign policy issues. And so he knew how to work Washington. What happened, I think, in the Bush administration was, first of all, that there were no allies to find. Congress, in terms of people with power, was solely in the Republican Party, and those people at the top of that particular totem pole were very much subservient to what the White House told them, and there were no allies to find. In the cabinet, there were no allies, and so Powell was very, very much alone. Whether one believes, and I believe it's a combination of things, that it was his, what he viewed as his soldier's loyalty, or his supreme self-confidence and real belief up until the end in what I concluded was somewhat misplaced way, that he would prevail. All of those led him to think that he was better off staying than leaving, and that the nation was better off.
I want to thank the listener for his call. I've got someone else waiting to talk with our guest, Karen DeYoung. Let's go now to a listener on line two, also in Champaign. Hi.
Hi. Good afternoon. Well, the fellow who just called, who really speaks, I think, to a lot of what all of us feel, we're disturbed about this, said part of what I wanted to say. But taking it a step farther, at this point, he was absolutely duped into doing what he did. I think he suspected the whole time that he was not being fed the right information when he spoke to the UN. So he's a good soldier. A good soldier, his first line, I always thought, was protect his troops. Even though he was then in the Department of State, surely that allegiance, it should have played a bigger role. It's just part of the disappointment that I feel in this. And then the final disappointment is, where is his voice now? Why doesn't he stand up now? A lot of people have stood up now, and I just don't understand why, having been treated the way he was treated, duped the way he was duped, and not getting Condoleezza Rice's support, which he should have had, I don't know. I'm like the other gentleman. This is just deeply troubling. And finally, I would say all of them, their first allegiance is not to the president. It's to all of us. And to remain honest and to, you know, do in the final analysis what's good for America. At some point, your allegiance to that has to take precedence over a president.
Karen DeYoung?
It was an interesting dynamic in the State Department. When Powell came into office there, the whole department was demoralized and had been under Madeleine Albright and even under Warren Christopher throughout the Clinton administration. The budget had been cut. Vacancies had not been filled. They were down, I think, 1,500 employees in the building. They couldn't recruit people to work in the State Department. It was a very demoralized place. Powell went in there with great pride in his own management skills, and he sort of thought of them as his army division, and he went and in fact, he did boost the budget. He did boost the recruiting. He increased the diversity. People there, on a personal level, were very, very devoted to him. And as things became worse during the Bush administration, I think there was a real division of feeling there among people who thought he should resign out of principle, and people who probably were in the majority who thought, oh my God, if he leaves, what will happen to us? And so they felt that he was fighting the good fight on their behalf, and that if he left, they would all suffer from it again, as would the country. You know, was Powell duped? I don't think he was duped. I think that he believed what he was saying at the Security Council. Certainly, it was believed by even the people who opposed an invasion. Many of our allies, France, Germany, those who very strongly opposed an invasion, it was not because they did not believe there were weapons of mass destruction. They did believe it. Their own intelligence services told them that there were such weapons there. The disagreement was over what to do about it, how urgent the threat was, and how to best combat it. The White House believed that there should be an invasion, and these other countries did not believe it. When Powell was putting together the speech that he gave at the Security Council, he was given a document that had been written in the White House, which he found much too strident, unsupportable, with a lot of charges that could not be proven. And he went out to the CIA and sat there for a week and tossed out a lot of it and pared it back. But what remained was, as we now know, was equally false, if not quite as strident. And I think they went at it in precisely the wrong way, and many people who participated in that exercise, who I talked to for the book, will now say that they began that exercise by looking, by starting with the premise that there were weapons of mass destruction, there was a strong relationship between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, and looking for the evidence that best proved it. They threw out a lot of the stuff that came from the White House because they felt that evidence wasn't good enough, but there were lots of things that remained, and that's what they used to make up the speech. The problem was that they never asked the obvious question, which I think any beginning intelligence analyst would ask, which is, what evidence do you have that says this is not true? Because, in fact, there was quite a bit of evidence. No one in the CIA brought it to his attention, but it also must be said that he didn't ask for it.
Let's take another call now, a listener on a cell phone on line one. Hi.
Hello. Yes, I would like to ask your guest today about the fact that Mr. Powell's presentation at the United Nations Security Council, a lot of Europeans and critics in the Middle East, also in other parts of the world, rated his presentation as if you are a fifth grader or under, you would believe it. If you are higher than a fifth grader, you would not buy it. And that's what turned out to be true after, you know, all the events that we all aware of. What do you think of that? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, the speech certainly didn't go over very well in Europe or the Middle East. You're absolutely correct about that. I think the primary audience for the speech was not they and not the Security Council itself. It was the American public. If you looked at the public opinion surveys before the speech, the country was pretty much divided in terms of those who thought that there needed to be military action very soon, that the threat was very urgent, and those who disagreed. I mean, that's why Powell was sent up there to give the speech, because he was considered the closest thing to a dove in the administration, not a warmonger, and was all of his own poll numbers were very, very high in terms of trust and respect. He went up there to persuade the American people, and if you look at the polls the next day, you see that, in fact, he succeeded. Editorials all over the country, even in those newspapers that, by and large, had opposed an invasion before that, said, well, you know, we had our doubts, but Colin Powell sure has convinced us. And the same with public opinion. I mean, you saw literally overnight a shift. Now, were people that willing to be convinced? I think you have to put it in the context of 9/11 and what the atmosphere was in this country, and also, to be honest, what the Bush administration, particularly the White House, pushed in terms of politicizing the fear in which the country was gripped. You know, it was very easy in those days to tell people that a threat was imminent, that al-Qaeda had something to do with it, that al-Qaeda had a relationship with Saddam Hussein, and once that connection was made, it was very easy to convince people that this was very necessary to do for the national security of the country.
Mm. Let's take another call. Also a listener on a cell phone in Champaign. Line 2, hi.
Hi. I just have a quick question which kind of leaps ahead in time in this discussion, but I'm curious if you have any ideas as to why Colin Powell stepped down. I've always been sort of curious as to why he might have done that, and he hasn't really popped up in any capacity after that, so I'll listen to the answer.
Yeah, you want to tell the story about when the resignation was asked for?
Yeah, this is the first chapter in my book. I think Powell was very, very tired as the election approached in 2004. He was discouraged. He had decided that he would only serve one term. But throughout that fall, a lot of things gave hints, at least, that they were going to change. There were rumors that Secretary Rumsfeld would be asked to step down as defense secretary. There was an upcoming election at the end of January in Iraq, in which a real Iraqi government was supposed to be elected. Yasser Arafat was very ill, and it was assumed that he was at death's door. He was viewed as a main impediment in the Middle East peace process, and there was a thought that this that things perhaps would look up in the new year. As the election approached, all of those things came together, and Powell started to think, well, maybe I shouldn't go. Maybe it's not such a good idea for me to go. I don't think he wanted to sign on for another 4 years, but he thought 6 months, another year. He's a perpetual optimist. He's very much a sort of glass half full kind of guy. Looked ahead and said, well, you know, we need some continuity here, and I think that I will stay. And I think he expected to be asked to stay. The election happened. Bush won. The weekend after the election, Bush and Andy Card, his chief of staff, and Condoleezza Rice, the national security advisor, went up to Camp David to look at the composition of the cabinet for the second term, came back on Monday and announced that John Ashcroft, the attorney general, would be leaving, Don Evans, the commerce secretary, would be leaving. That was it for the moment. On Wednesday, which was the 10th of November, Powell got a telephone call in his office from Card, not from Bush, from Card, the chief of staff, saying, the president has decided to make a change. The president would like your resignation letter on his desk on November 12th, 2 days hence. There wasn't very much discussion. There wasn't a call from Bush. Powell told only his deputy, Richard Armitage, who was also his close friend, went home and typed up his resignation letter himself on his home computer, brought it back and went into the White House that Friday and dropped it off. There was no discussion. There was no further discussion with Bush. And in fact, he didn't meet with Bush on the subject of his departure until the week before the inauguration, toward the end of January, where the White House had scheduled sort of pro forma sit-downs with all the departing cabinet secretaries. And when Powell's turn came, he went into the office and Bush seemed perplexed and didn't appear to know why he was there. And Powell said, well, this is supposed to be our goodbye sit-down. And Bush said, oh, yes, of course, and then called Andy Card in because he, throughout the first term, seemed to have a real reluctance to sit down with Powell alone. Card came in, and they chatted for a while, and Powell had decided that he was going to unload in ways that he hadn't throughout the administration and said, look, you've got a big problem in Iraq. If you can't turn this around in the next couple of months, it may in fact be doomed. It's fine to talk about democracy, it's fine to talk about elections, but if you can't train an army there that believes in its own government and is prepared to defend the country, then you're in big trouble. And he also went on to talk about the poisonous relationship between the State Department and the Pentagon, and cited some names of specific people in the Pentagon and told Bush that it was undermining his foreign policy and his diplomacy. Bush basically didn't react, said, good to know you, shook his hand, and that was the end of it. Mm.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Journalist Karen DeYoung, our guest this afternoon. She is the author of Soldier, The Life of Colin Powell. We have a listener waiting to talk with us now in Terre Haute on line 4. Hi.
Hello. During the 1960s, there was an Afro-American congressman from Harlem. Adam Clayton Powell. Was he related at all to Colin Powell?
No, not as far as I know, no.
Oh, that's something I always wondered about. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the question this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else toll free, 800-222-9455. Colin Powell's career began in the Army, and so he served many presidents from the time he first signed up. He also served in the administrations of Presidents Reagan, the first President Bush, Bill Clinton, and now George W. Bush. What does he identify as his accomplishments in public service, in those administrations?
Certainly, as President Reagan's last national security advisor, he believes that he, and I think with some justification, that he brought an organization and an openness to an administration that in the wake of Iran-Contra was in big trouble. He organized President Reagan's last meetings with Mikhail Gorbachev, and I think left that relationship in good stead. In the Bush administration, the first Bush administration, he certainly takes credit, and I think most people would give him credit for orchestrating the Gulf War of 1991, making sure it was done at the right time with the right size force, and in achieving the objectives that they set of basically driving the Iraqis out of Kuwait. You know, he takes credit in a very military sense for things that I think most people would not remember in foreign policy terms. At the end of the Cold War, there was a lot of pressure to cut the military very drastically. He played a very major role and is very proud of what he did to reorganize the military, to cut its size in a way that he felt did not undermine its mission. I think he considers that a big success. In the current President Bush's first term, it's interesting, you know, the last interview I did with Powell was about 3 months after he left office, and it was the only time I saw him when he was not in his State Department office, and he was quite, he was testy. He was upset that a lot of the newspaper coverage of his departure had been quite critical and said that he was a person of great stature who essentially had come in to the State Department with an enormous amount of capital in terms of public trust, and had allowed Bush to spend it all for his own ends rather than Powell's. Powell then listed off a list of his accomplishments as Secretary of State: best relations with China and Russia in many years, coming up with the six-party talks for North Korea, establishing a roadmap for peace in the Middle East, averting a nuclear war between India and Pakistan. All of these he listed as accomplishments. It must be said that although they were the stated policy of the administration at the time he left, it had taken a very long time to get there, and those particular policies had lost a lot in the interim. The other interesting thing was that he never mentioned Iraq, either as an accomplishment or even as something he was upset about. It was almost as if he had sort of wiped it from his mind, or at least in terms of his own participation in it, but he certainly did not consider his participation in one of his accomplishments in office. Mm.
How open was he with you? Was he at all reluctant to talk with you?
You know, Powell is unusual in this administration in that he believes that he benefits more from talking to the media than from not talking to the media. He has always been very media savvy. Journalists tend to like him because he treats them like human beings. When you go on a trip with Colin Powell overseas as a journalist, you ride on his plane. He walks up and down the aisle. He tells jokes. He tells stories. He'll talk about policy. He's very, very accessible and always has been in his government career. When I decided to do this book, I did not say anything to him. I didn't know him very well. I only knew him from having covered some events. And I went ahead and signed a contract and started doing it, and then actually wrote him a letter, said I was doing it and that I would like to sit down and talk to him in a very structured way, and I proposed a series of interviews on very specific topics: his decision not to run for president, the Iraq war, his relationship with Bush, and he agreed to do that. We sat down for five interviews over a period of almost 2 years in his office, his State Department office, and I think he was relatively open. The only condition he imposed is that I would not use any of the material in the Washington Post, where I was on leave, and essentially would not publish it until it was published in the book itself. So again, you know, he people who work for him as spokesmen and public affairs officers are often very frustrated because he believes, I think rightly, that he's his own best spokesman and his own best press agent, which was something, one of many reasons why he was odd man out in this administration.
Let's talk with another listener before we're out of time here. A listener in Urbana, line one, hi.
One last question about General Powell's future. Has he ever had any presidential ambitions? I began to think of him as possibly the next general that became a president, but I'm not sure if that's possible. What is your opinion?
Well, you know, in 1995, he had been retired from the military for 2 years. He had written his autobiography, which was enormously, enormously successful. And there, it's hard to imagine now, but there was a wave of nonpartisan support for him to run for president. And I think he came very close to doing it, to the point where he actually wrote the speech in which he was going to announce his candidacy. He ultimately decided not to do it. At the time, he had never even been registered in a political party. He had voted certainly for President Reagan and the first President Bush, but he'd also voted for John Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, Jimmy Carter in his first election. So he really thought of himself as nonpartisan. As he started to do the calculations, again in 1995, about running for president, he realized that although the polls said that he could probably beat Clinton as a Republican, he had somewhat liberal social views at a time when the Republican Party was turning increasingly toward the right, and
That's
it was unlikely
sure.
that he could ever get the Republican nomination. He was pro-abortion rights, he was pro-affirmative action, and there were people in the Republican Party who basically controlled the primary process who very much did not want him to be the nominee, even though the Republicans' own polls said that he was the only person who could win. At the end of the day, I think his family didn't want him to run. There was a possibility, despite his enormous popularity, that he would actually lose, which was something he was not prepared to contemplate. And I think he basically doesn't like politics. He would have liked to have been president. I think the idea of running for president and all the compromises and glad-handing and money-raising that entails was repugnant to him.
Yeah. One of the things we haven't talked about this afternoon is his family and this. And there's a fascinating story there here in this book, Karen. I'm thinking now of his wife, Alma. When they were courting, he was going to go off to be a soldier, and he says to her, "We'll write to one another." And she said, "No, we won't. I'm too old to be a pen pal." And
right.
That settled it right then and there. So a fascinating family life as well, not only with the Colin Powell and his wife Alma Johnson Powell, but his parents' lives as well. One last question here that I want to ask before we have to wrap up: if there's a lesson from this life, these times of this man, for the country, for future national leaders, what is it?
That's a good question. I think that he. I don't think he believes this now, but perhaps he will come to think it in the future, and certainly future historians, I believe, will come to this conclusion that it's not enough to give your private advice when you truly believe that the government is headed on a mistaken path. That Powell had the opportunity, whether he would have succeeded or not is a question, but he certainly had the opportunity to change the course of history and decided not to take that opportunity.
Yeah. Also, it seems to me that here we have a story of the dangers of a dysfunctional foreign policy apparatus.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, I think again, Powell looks at it, as I said, he's a creature of institutions, that there needs to be a structure, and that within that structure, right decisions have a far better chance of being made than with no structure at all. And I think that what has happened in terms of the decision making inside the Bush administration ultimately will bear that out.
Karen DeYoung, thank you for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me, Celeste.
Karen DeYoung is an assistant editor at the Washington Post. She is the author of Soldier, The Life of Colin Powell, a book published by Knopf. And that interview from the archives, it was conducted on October 18th of this year. Soldier, The Life of Colin Powell, the author, Karen DeYoung. It's 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Let's check in now with Dave Dickey to find out what happened today in Kansas City and Chicago. Dave?
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. Of course, the market's closing at noon today, and it was a pretty doggone good day at the Chicago Board of Trade as well as in Kansas City, especially in wheat where we saw double-digit increases and followed through on yesterday's gains. We'll talk to Mike Zuzulo at Risk Management Commodities in Lafayette, Indiana, at 6 past the hour about the implications of the strong wheat performance this week. On the week, it finishing over 15 cents higher in the lead March option month. Let's look at the particulars in Kansas City. March wheat, a high on the day of 518 and three quarters, a low of 507 and a half, settling 518, up 9 3/4. May, a high of 524, a low of 514 and a half, settling 522, up 5. At the Board of Trade, March wheat, a high on the day of 515, a low of 502 and a quarter, settling 514, so it settled at the top of the range, up 10 3/4. May, a high of 518, a low of 508, settling 517 and a half, up 9 3/4. July, high of 505 and a half, a low of 491, settling 503 and 3/4, up 11 3/4. September, a high of 504, a low of 496 and a half, settling 504, up 9, and the December, a high of 513, a low of 502, settling 512, up 8 on the day. March corn, a high on the day of 384 and a quarter, a low of 378, settling 384, up 6 1/4. May, a high of 391 and 3/4, a low of 385 and 3/4, settling 391 and a half, up 6. July, a high of 397 and a half, a low of 391 and 3/4, settling 396 and 3/4, up 5 1/2. September, a high of 382, a low of 377 and 3/4, settling 381 and a quarter, up 3 3/4. December, a high on the day of 371 and a half. That's the new contract high in the new corn. The low, 368, settling 371, up 3. March, a high of 377, a low of 373 and a half. Settled 376 and a half, up 2 1/2. May, a high of 379, a low of 376 and a half,